Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. We start our show today with an update on Monday's story about the wind turbine that exploded and sparked several spot fires at the Kumeyaay Wind Farm on the Campo Indian Reservation. East County Magazine's investigation has turned up some troubling findings. The fires burned about half acre total, but retired CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Mark Ostrander told us that could have been far worse. Luckily, it was not during a Santa Ana, said the former fire chief, who has long warned that wind turbines pose major fire hazards in the backcountry. A red flag alert for high fire danger had been in effect just one day earlier. While windy, the gusts when the fire occurred were not approaching the high speeds that occur in the area during Santa Ana winds on this cool winter day. Even with such favorable weather conditions, it took a response from multiple agencies, including CAL FIRE, the U.S. Forest Service, and Heartland Fire, to bring the blazes under control, including airplanes and a helicopter dropping fire retardant to save homes near the brush fires. David Elliott, a neighbor and member of the Manzanita Indian tribe, told us he's been hearing unusual noises from the turbines in recent days that sound like bearings could be going out, he told us. They screech and they howl. It sounds like many of them are pretty much ready for an overhaul. The project is currently offline. Cost of the destroyed turbine alone will likely be in the millions. It's unclear how long the project could be offline, but back in 2009, when an explosion knocked the same wind farm offline for over 3 months, it required the replacement of all 75 blades on all 25 turbines. Mike Moeller of CAL FIRE told East County Magazine that the cause has not yet been determined. Now, as for fighting fires, the Campo turbines are much shorter than the new turbines approved by the federal and county governments for Iberdrola's Thule Wind project in nearby McCain Valley, where about 100 turbines would tower 500 feet tall. Former Chief Ostrander and others have raised concerns that aerial fire drops would be ineffective at such heights, forcing ground crews to just stand back and wait for the fire to burn out of the wind facility before battling what could by then be an inferno. The turbines and blades were manufactured by Gamesa and owned by Infogen, which is an Australian company. East County Magazine has contacted the Campo Tribal Office as well as Infogen, the owner of the wind facility, for comment but has not received a response. Gamesa has a troubled track record of turbines that have caught fire, as well as washing its hands of responsibility for blade failures that include those at the Campo facility. In 2012, a Gamesa turbine caught fire at an Iberdrola wind power project back in Iowa. Gamesa claimed the company's maintenance contract had expired. Gamesa turbines have also been linked to two turbine fires in Pennsylvania in 2009 and 2012. Iberdrola previously had issues with Gamesa turbine blades also whirling off chunks of debris at the Campo facility in 2009, as we mentioned. Other turbine manufacturers have also had fires in both new and old turbines. Gamesa refused to accept liability initially in five legal actions filed by U.S. wind projects over warranty disputes for hefty repairs and lost production. That includes over $34 million in turbine repairs at the Kumeyaay Wind Farm. A witness told East County Magazine he saw a blue flash that radiated out through the wind farm back in a storm in December 2009 before that project went dark. The suits alleged that Gamesa blades suffered from design and manufacturing defects. Now, the Campo Wind Farm was built by the predecessor of Pattern Energy, which, interestingly, listed the Campo project among its successes when it applied to the California Public Utilities Commission to build the Ocotillo Express wind project in Ocotillo. Now, as for Infogen's lawsuit with Gamesa, that was settled in June over the catastrophe at the Campo wind facility in 2009, when they had to replace all 75 turbines. But now, Boulevard Planning Group Chair Donna Tisdale reveals the 75 turbine blades from the 2009 catastrophic failure are still laying on the ground at the wind farm and are highly flammable. Tisdale said local planners were advised that the blades were kept there in Campo for evidence of the Infogen versus Scamisa lawsuit, but the suit was settled in June, so why are the blades still on the ground? The settlement in that case required Gamesa to provide warranties, turbine maintenance service, and replacement components for the turbines until June of 2028, and to be responsible for the cost of all turbine component replacements, including blades, subject to certain liability caps, at an annual fixed fee. So why are the blades left on the ground for all these years, ever since the 2009 catastrophe, it appears? This raises the issue of whether or not Gamesa has been adequately maintaining the blades on these turbines, especially given David Elliott's statements about screeching and howling from the turbines not long before this fire. Christopher Noland is a planner on the Boulevard Planning Group. He told East County Magazine that planners are in the dark as to whether or not recommended maintenance is being done at this facility because it's on tribal land and not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. Nothing about that is public record, he said, adding that he is very concerned about safety at this project as well as Iberdrola's planned Thule Wind project in nearby McCain Valley. Asked about Thule Wind, Noland had this to say. Anything that goes up at Thule Wind is a fire danger for the entire county. Directionally, where it would be located, and the direction of the Santa Ana winds, it spells trouble. Gamesa isn't the only windmaker with a troubled record, as previously noted. Vestas has been plagued with problems. Within the last couple of years in Tehachapi, a turbine built by Danish manufacturer NEG Micon burst into flames, and in June 2012, a wind turbine fire in the whitewater area of Riverside County charred 367 acres, after spreading to become a wildland fire, despite having the required clearance around the turbine bases. A turbine fire in Palm Springs a few years ago shut down a freeway, and most recently a wind turbine sparked a wildland fire in the Netherlands in October 2013. In fact, there's been well over 100 documented fires. Although the industry says this is rare, and we recently started a Google search term for wind turbine fires, and we're finding them coming up almost every single week. In McCain Valley, site of the proposed Iberdrola Thule Wind Facility, turbines up to 450 feet tall, with wingspans the size of football fields, would be located just 455 feet from the main road and 760 feet from a campground. There is just one road in and out in this long valley, and it's not even fully paved. What happens if a turbine catches fire or collapses? How will campers and hikers and off-roaders get out? A recent Iberdrola project in Groton, New Hampshire, doesn't exactly inspire confidence. Iberdrola failed to schedule inspections during construction and failed to install an automatic fire suppression system in its wind turbine housings. And now, the state attorney general's office has announced that the state fire marshal there has the authority to shut the project down. Whether that will happen remains to be seen. Despite its trouble-prone record at the Kumeyaay Wind Facility in Campo, Infogen has proposals in the work to build two solar projects in nearby Boulevard, California, here in East County, one of them on the Campo Reservation right next to the turbines. Infogen has been reportedly plagued with $1 billion in debt, stemming from its origins with Babcock & Brown, yes, the same company that spawned Pattern Energy, developer of that trouble-prone Ocotillo wind energy facility. In Ocotillo, a brand-new turbine dropped a multi-ton blade on a public trail, prompting a worldwide curtailment of these turbines. And East County Magazine's investigation revealed major scandals, including corruption convictions and bribery allegations against Siemens, the turbine blade manufacturer, in many countries. And East County Magazine investigation also found blade throws are not rare, as the industry claims. Siemens and other manufacturers have had multiple prior incidences of that around the world. Pattern also fell far short of meeting its wind production estimates provided to the federal government in order to obtain taxpayer-subsidized wind production tax credits for the Ocotillo project. Both Ocotillo and Thule Wind also relied on Raptor studies by David Bittner, the eagle expert who's been convicted in federal court of illegally taking an eagle, who had no permits for years and who was found to have four freezers full of dead, federally protected migratory birds, totally illegal, further tainting the credibility of the wind industry in our region and elsewhere. Local planners have raised concerns over potential fire hazards from numerous projects in the Boulevard Campo area lately, where fire stations have been dark. They've had dark days recently, even during peak fire season, despite other massive new energy projects going in, including substations and high-voltage power lines. And while the county is working on restoring that staffing and says the staffing has been restored for now, who knows what the future will hold. Bonnie Price is the past president of the East County Democratic Club, and she tried unsuccessfully to persuade the county and state Democratic parties to support a resolution calling for a ban on wind turbines in high fire risk areas of East County, predicting exactly the sort of thing that just happened. In response to this week's fire at the Campbell facility, she wrote to us, "Sad to report, wind turbines do what many deniers say they cannot do. Chalk up another hit for SDG&E's archaic and dangerous grid system using alternative energy sources badly," said Price, who supports rooftop solar, as do many backcountry residents, and other forms of green power that do not endanger the citizens here. On the Brush Fire Party line on Facebook, local residents are also sounding off. "Millions of our tax dollars up in smoke," wrote Jan Whistler-Clark, referring to those production tax credits that the wind industry gets. Kelly Fuller posted, "More of these wind turbines are being planned in the eastern backcountry where fire stations have been dark, no staff for many days this summer and fall, Boulevard in particular. The fire risk is real." Ironically, Monday's fire in Campo comes just days after the Bureau of Indian Affairs just issued a finding of no significant impact for a new 1-megawatt wind turbine planned at the truck stop at Golden Acorn Casino. Donna Tisdale, chair of Boulevard's planning group, says the process is corrupt, in her opinion. She's also co-founder of the Protect Our Communities Foundation, one of several community and environmental groups that has filed suit seeking to halt the proposed Thule Wind project in McCain Valley. Now, San Diego Gas and Electric Company provided mitigation for its Sunrise Powerlink project in McCain Valley and some other projects out there, which included a foam truck, and this supposed mitigation is currently housed not anywhere near Boulevard or Campo, but instead about an hour away in Moreno Valley. That's because of the inconsistent staffing at the Boulevard Fire Station, we learned during a recent meeting at Supervisor Jacob's office with concerned residents and fire officials. Although the overtime has restored the staffing, it's unclear when or if the foam truck will be moved any closer to the Boulevard Campo area, where the major wind projects, substations, and power lines all pose fire risks. The prospect of a wind turbine sparking a brush fire in McCain Valley has residents such as David Elliott alarmed. "It's a huge concern," he concluded. "I'm sure that houses would be burned down and lives could be lost." Former Chief Mark Ostrander agrees. He's repeatedly testified that a fire at a wind facility could become an inferno and that it could threaten all of San Diego, just like the 2003 Cedar Fire or the 2007 firestorms, yes, two of the worst wildfires in California history that devastated our region, one of them fueled by 100-mile-an-hour hurricane-force winds. Supervisor Diane Jacob has also voiced opposition to wind turbines in the backcountry due to the severe and unmitigatable fire hazards. But despite her objections, the other four supervisors recently voted to approve not only Thule Wind, but a county wind ordinance that could allow many more major turbine projects in this tinder-dry, fire-prone region over the objections of those who fought wildfires and the residents who've lived through the terror of wildfires fueled by these high winds, the very winds that entice wind developers to the area. Lawsuits filed by the Protect Our Communities Foundation, Backcountry Against Dumps, and Donna Tisdale are pending over Ocotillo as well as Thule Wind and the county wind ordinance, with fire danger high on the list of concerns raised in the litigation. Now, the Campo fire adds fuel to the firestorm of controversy over whether or not wind energy facilities can possibly be safe in our already fire-prone region.
This is Leon Thompson with the wrap-up for our sports writer David Dickinson on last weekend's CIF Championship football game playoff between Monte Vista Monarchs and the Sweetwater High Red Devils. Sweetwater took the crown for the first time in nearly three decades, crushing the Monarchs' hopes for victory. Monte Vista was expected to cruise through this Division IV rematch on December 8th against Sweetwater for the San Diego CIF crown. But playoffs at any level discounts regular season play as a whole new atmosphere. The ironic stat in this battle is not a single pass was thrown in the Monarch triumph early in the regular season play. This time it was a pass that stole the game. The Monarch's strength all season long has been the elite rushing attack led by running back Jermeil Jackson. This time around, Monte Vista was stymied for a mere 186 yards, all rushing, and only amassed 31 yards total in the entire second half of play. This hard-fought contest was full of turnovers and miscues on both sides. The slippery weather added to the ball security issues as well. Monte Vista came into this game with 7 wins and 5 losses on the season. Sweetwater's record was 8 wins and 4 losses. Monte Vista and Sweetwater teams both started their regular season play slow, but started to heat up at the right time. The Monarchs had the heart and the desire to take home their first championship since losing to Helix 20-3 in 2003. A complete opposite outcome from their previous meeting with the Red Devils, a thumping 34-3. But the Monarchs were shut out this time 7-0, the lowest scoring affair in San Diego CIF history. What ultimately led the Monarchs' loss was turnover number 3 that ended the game. Another key to Monte Vista's success this year was ball security. Heading into the fourth quarter, there was still no score, and with two high-powered running backs being stymied, something had to give. Some trickery would be necessary. On the third down and just inches from the 15-yard line, running back Raven Middleton received a quick pitch. But instead of powering up the middle, he lobbed a 15-yard pass to wingback Antonio Garcia. Touchdown for Sweetwater with little time left. This would seal the deal and end a 29-year drought for the Sweetwater Red Devils. The Monarchs' leaders were held in check. Running back Jameel Jackson finished the evening with a season-low 17 carries for 64 yards. And his partner in crime, quarterback Thomas Walker, had 5 rushes for an astonishing 54 yards. The Monarchs fought hard all season long and had many accomplishments, both defensively and offensively. With coach Ron Hamamoto at the helm, Monte Vista will be a threat for many years to come.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing T.B. Smith, local author of a novel called The Sticking Place, and a retired San Diego police lieutenant. My guest, like his fictional protagonist Luke Jones, was a literature major and is also a scholar of all things Shakespearean. Welcome, T.B. Tim, it's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's begin with your history as a local police lieutenant. What was it like doing police work in San Diego, and how has it led you to a writing career?
Well, actually, my interest in writing led me to my police career.
Okay.
I majored in Renaissance literature and graduated from college in 1977, really didn't know what to do with my education. Was a fan of Joe Wamba's work and went into police work to give me something to write about. And when I was first started with San Diego PD, we had the highest per capita death rate in the country, officers being killed.
Really?
Second highest serious injury rate due to assault, so it was definitely a volatile time.
They seem like such disparate interests, though, Shakespeare, Renaissance, and police work.
Yes, I didn't know that I would be interested in police work until I got into police work.
Oh, I see.
I expected to do it for a couple of years and then use that as a springboard to write about. I ended up with a 27-year career. And I do get a lot of comments about they seem like unusual interests. But it's worked out well for me because it's given me the opportunity to create a character who shares the same interest and to use that as a way to explore the impact of police work on individual officers.
Did you enjoy it, police work?
Yes, I did. Police work is one of the few jobs I can think of. It's not for everybody, but people would ask me, do you enjoy your job? And my response was not, yes, I enjoy my job. My response was, I have fun when I go to work. Now, I was young, and I was very athletic. I had been a wrestler in high school and college and was, you know, very fit, and the career was a good fit for my energy level and my interests.
Okay, well, let's talk about your novel. The Sticking Place has been described as a gritty police procedural about a Shakespeare-quoting rookie cop who fights crooks and fellow officers as he learns to survive on the streets of 1970s San Diego. And the mayor and police chief, Jerry Sanders, called this book a must-read for every cop who ever worked the streets of a major city and for anyone with an appreciation of realistic literature that depicts what it will always mean to be a cop. So, tell us more about your protagonist, Luke Jones, and what he represents to you.
Luke Jones, like me, was a Shakespeare quoting cop. I used to literally jump up on the table at the Academy and spout Shakespeare. And I remember once when I was at a bar with having a discussion with one of the communications dispatcher, and she asked me what I majored in college, and I told her, and she didn't believe me, so I jumped up onto the bar and quoted something from Richard II. So the best way to describe Luke is he's a bit of a misfit. He's in a paramilitary organization, doesn't have a lot of tolerance for military structure. He's very outspoken. He speaks his mind even to higher-ups, even what it would be to the detriment of his career. Mm-hmm. And I use the interest in Shakespeare mostly as a way to show the reader how difficult coping with a career in law enforcement can be in a major city.
See. So give us an example of a quote that would be offered in that kind of situation where someone's under the stress of police work.
Well, actually, the quote that I can think of when I was challenged by the communications dispatcher and she asked me to get up and prove it was I got up on the bar and I quoted something from Richard II. Of comfort, let no man speak. Let's talk of graves, of worms, and epitaphs. Make dust our paper, and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth.
Wow. That's intense and beautifully put. Let's go to the Shakespeare festivals. What do you do at festivals? I mean, how often do you go to them, and how do they fit into your future plans for this character? Because I understand that Luke Jones it's a series. Yes. And so how are you planning, or how do you use the Shakespeare festivals? Or is that just a personal hobby?
It's a combination. Every festival is different. Where I split my time between here in San Diego and Ashland, Oregon, the home of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And that is a small town of 20,000 people. It has more than 300,000 people a year attend the plays, and it's really the main industry of the town. They do 11 plays a year in a season of about 8.5 months. Typically four are Shakespeare, or at least our three will be Shakespeare and another one classical. I am a preacher's kid, and I use quoting Shakespeare the way my dad used to in sermons as a way to accent and make points about certain things. So I use the Shakespeare festivals as a way to keep inundated with my interest and love of the language. And as I'm sitting in the plays, I will frequently hear a quotation that I know I'm going to come back to that and use it. And then as I'm composing later on, I'll find the right structure for that.
So it's staying the words, keeping the words fresh.
Yes.
Does your protagonist actually go to festivals?
In the first novel, The Sticking Place, he actually did. There's a couple of paragraphs or so that refer to his having been away at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as a way of explaining how he had been apart from some intrigue and problems that had developed while he was gone. In the second book that is just released, he does not go to Shakespeare. He has not gone to a Shakespeare Festival, but he continues to use his love of Shakespeare and other writers as a way to reference the world.
So tell us about this book that's just been released.
It's called A Fellow of Infinite Jest, and the title comes from Hamlet. And among several things that it does is it explores the impact of the PSA 182 plane crash that happened here in San Diego. I was an officer who responded to that, and I used that as a way of exploring how impactful the job can be. And then there's also the crook, the main bad guy. The incidents that involved him were actually based on real-life incidents that happened a few years later. So what I have a tendency to do is take things from my experiences of friends of mine and my knowledge about major incidents that have happened and meld them together into fictional plots.
Right. Great. Tim, I know you also write what you call Cops World Blog. And in a 2012 blog entry, you announced that you would be working with a different charity nonprofit organization each month and donating 10% of all the sales generated from your website. I was very impressed with that. Very generous of you. And are you still doing that, and how has that worked?
Yes. What I did was I formed affiliations with the charities for the first book, and then I thought at the time that I would have my second book out in the next year, and we would use the concurrent months mm-hmm. with the same charities. It took me an extra year because of health problems to get the second book out. So I'm doing that again, and this month the 10% of all sales, no longer just from the website, but from all sales, are going to go to the Retired Fire and Police Association.
Oh, wonderful. That's great to know. Well, one last question. Tell us about what comes next, the next Luke Jones book in the series, and when you project that might be available.
My next book in the Luke Jones series, if you haven't noticed, I always have Shakespearean quotations, and they're ironic in some way or another. And the next book is going to be entitled Winter of Our Discontent, which comes from Richard III. And it's going to continue exploring the impact of police work on Luke Jones. I envision this series as the first book beginning with Luke's very first radio call and the last book ending with his retirement. And it's going to continue on that journey.
And with the retirement being present day?
Yes.
How much has San Diego changed in the time that you've worked in police work?
Oh, it's changed tremendously. Ironically, crime rate has gone down significantly.
That's good to know.
There are several reasons for that. But the biggest change is San Diego has emerged into a world-class city. If you go downtown and you see the public art along the waterway and you see all of the development and those things are very impressive. When I started working patrol in downtown San Diego, and it was had the feel of a small town, very few right. high rises, and it was just very rampant with crime, and people, average people, would have a tendency to stay away at night and would be inhabited by sailors and people who were going to prey on them as their victims
right.
and it's really emerged as a big city in terms of the way it views itself and the way it presents itself.
Well, that's a fascinating perspective. Thanks for sharing your knowledge. Our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure.
And for more information on T.B. Smith, please visit his website at www.lukejonesnovels.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This is Leon Thompson with a reminder from Sheriff Bill Gore for holiday shoppers that you'd better watch out for crooks. Thieves are easily tempted when people leave bags of gifts in plain sight in their vehicles or display presents under a tree in a front window. The San Diego County Sheriff's Department is reminding everyone to be aware of criminals looking for easy targets during the holiday season. Thieves do their best holiday looting in other people's homes and vehicles. Their victory is even sweeter when doors and windows are left unlocked. The Sheriff's Department is doing its part by planning various operations throughout the county to keep shoppers safe. The stepped-up patrols include probation checks, undercover operations, horse and bike patrols, drunk driving patrols, and juvenile curfew sweeps. They're also setting up Skywatch, a bulletproof glass-enclosed basket lifted 25 feet up in the air on a crane with a heat-sensing zoom lens camera to give deputies a better vantage point in shopping center parking lots. You could say they know if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sakes. Earlier this month, Skywatch was deployed in Santee Trolley Center and monitored the parking lots. Skywatch will also be set up on December 13th in Encinitas and in Santee again on December 18th. Driving under the influence or DUI patrols will be taking place Friday and Saturday in Vista and again next Saturday. DUI patrols will also happen every weekend in Santee. To see a full schedule of holiday watch activities, check the sheriff's website at www.sdsheriff.net. Deputies are also distributing holiday shopping crime tips in various communities and sending senior volunteer patrol members into shopping centers for high-visibility patrols.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And I'm back today with Ben Colasso, the president of the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce. And Ben has been a candidate in the past for the El Cajon City Council, and he owns several businesses out here, and he's been a very active member of the community. And today we're here to talk about some of the political issues across the San Diego region that the Chaldean American community is interested in. But Ben, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Let's start with the San Diego mayoral race. What issue or issues are of concern to Chaldeans in that race?
I think the number one issue for Chaldeans, now mind you, the population in for that race in San Diego County is, I mean, a ton. Millions of people live within that voting district and county. And the Chaldean American population numbers at about 20,000 in the San Diego County area. Now, I mean, this is a small minority, but it's enough to make a difference in such a tight
race. How many of those
race.
Are actually registered to vote, you know?
It's hard to know, but our chamber is working to register and educate voters, Chaldean American voters, on the procedures of registration and to keep a census and information on that. So if you will invite me on later on, we will have more of an accurate number for you with respect to San Diego.
I'm sure we can do that.
But with San Diego residents that reside there, I think the number one thing for them is going to be which candidate is pro-business, pro-small business. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the number one thing, or at least that's what's being brought up to our chamber's attention as they look to us for guidance and for a breakdown of each candidate and what they stand for.
Yeah, and that's because so many Chaldeans own businesses. I think you've told me something like two-thirds of them own at least one business.
Right, yeah. They own, you know, like I say, in all of San Diego County, there are 80,000 Chaldean Americans. 60% own one business. 38% of that 60 own two or more. So it's quite a culture.
Sure. Now, there's also been some issues in the news lately about some political leaders who've made comments that were deemed insensitive to the Chaldean community or even the broader Middle Eastern and even other minority communities. One of those was former Mayor Mark Lewis in El Cajon, who left office shortly after getting criticized for remarks suggesting that Chaldeans were, you know, seeking out freebies from the government and food stamps who may or may not have been deserving. More recently, we've seen Congressman Duncan Hunter made a remark. He was talking about the situation in Iran, saying that he might back nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, to be used if an airstrike were launched against Iran to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. But he went further even than that and made a remark to the effect that there's a culture within the Middle Eastern community of encouraging lying. How was that received here among the local Chaldean community?
We are obviously an understanding and forgiving group of a community.
And it should be noted, by the way, that Congressman Hunter did send a representative supporting your chamber and providing a resolution in support of the new enterprise. So he certainly has made some outreach and some inroads to the Chaldeans.
He definitely has. And he along with we received two awards, actually, for our Chamber of Commerce, another one from Senator Joel Anderson. Mm-hmm. But I think that though we are all human and we all make mistakes – and we understand and recognize that. Though I have to make this distinction that in this America and in this, we're almost in 2014, mm-hmm. there are certain words or rhetoric that should never come out of a politician or anybody's mouth, but let alone a politician's mouth. Mm-hmm. Words such as, you know, using nuclear weapons as a first means to resolve issues. What happened to diplomacy, and what happened to working it out across the table?
Of nuclear weapons anywhere in the Middle East would be of impact to the homeland for many of the Chaldeans. I imagine that would be of great concern to many people.
Well, definitely. But the Middle East is so diverse. You can't take a wand and spread it all across and say the Middle Eastern people or people from the Middle East are, and then you fill in the blank. There is no – we have over 30 religions in the Middle East. I mean, just Iraq alone is home to 9 religions that I know of. Mm-hmm. And you take things, for example, Iraq has the Arabs, then within the Arab community, there are Christians there. There are Kurds who are not Arab, who have their own language and currency and so on. The same thing you have in Egypt, you have with the Coptics and then the Islamic community. The same thing you have in Syria and going on now with the Syrians, and then you have the Syriac Christian Church. And then the same thing with Jordan. There is no wand to spread across.
The Shiites and the Sunnis. And
And then you have the difference with Persians. Then there are Persians, and then there are Iranians, all coming from Iran. Then there are Christians who live in Iran, as well as there are some Jews who live in Iran.
So you find it troubling that a high-level official like that would make such a broad-brush statement that has such negative connotation toward all Middle Easterners. It should be noted that his aide later said he was really referring to the culture in certain countries and the leadership, but the statement that he made on TV didn't make that distinction.
Well, it didn't to many people. He was, I think, specifically, as that interview was going on, was specifically speaking about Iran. But even within Iran, you have to understand that their system of government with their Ayatollah and then their parliamentary style system is really complicated. It's not like it's how we kind of have it here. So mm-hmm. The typical Iranian or Persian or a citizen of Iran, let's say, listening to an elected official make those sorts of remarks, they're going to find it difficult to digest and in doing business in the future with America. Because if they think that this is the perception of our elected officials saying this, it's just in bad taste. We need to be better. We need to be better as a country with our elected officials than the rest of the countries. Mm-hmm. We don't need this sort of rhetoric. So if they have said in the past, and I'm certain that they have, the Iranian government has said, used words of animosity towards their neighboring countries or even towards the United States, we need to be better than them. We need to set the precedent.
What do you think the solution is to encourage leaders who represent East County, which has many, many Middle Eastern people now, to be more culturally sensitive in their remarks, or is the answer to replace them?
It's the answer is not to replace them. That's not it at all. That's almost saying, well, everybody who isn't Middle Eastern is ignorant to mm-hmm. or not respectful to people from the Middle East or Middle Eastern descent. That's not true at all. I think there is no one entity or organization that's going to bring up or raise whether it's the Middle Eastern community or the Chaldean American community. It's not going to uplift them. The only people or organization or entity that can uplift the Middle Eastern community is the Middle Eastern community.
So it's not an issue of getting more government aid for, say, recent immigrants or refugees who've come here, in your opinion. It's a matter of the Chaldean community banding together and finding more ways to help its own members.
It definitely is that. I mean, the reason why we started our Chamber of Commerce was that professional Chaldean Americans didn't find a place or were having a hard time finding an organization to represent them, and that's why we created our chamber. But moreover, our chamber is mm-hmm. In the process of creating a political action committee. Also, it's creating a foundation help out in our community, whether it be for raising money for different awarenesses or our political action committee supporting or opposing certain propositions or ordinances or laws whom we think are harmful to not just the Middle Eastern community,
yeah.
but to the entire San Diego community.
So with all of the business people, some of whom are quite well-to-do, the Chamber and the PAC, potentially you envision this becoming a political force to be reckoned with down the future in East County.
Not just in East County. We have a five-year goal of being the strongest political action committee in San Diego County.
Interesting.
Because we have, and again, this all is deriving from that our chamber is not just for Chaldeans, not just for Middle Eastern people. To keep in mind that our board is made up of people from different walks of life and ideology. So when we are speaking specifically on the platform of economics.
Are there issues at the county level or the state level, Ben, that your chamber is keeping an eye on right now?
Well, obviously, we're trying to keep an eye on and we're looking at the minimum wage talk that's been happening.
Yeah, what are your views on that? And this is kind of a double-edged sword in a way. On the one hand, we have an extremely high poverty rate in East County, particularly in the El Cajon area where many Chaldeans are. And on the other hand, obviously raising the minimum wage can be difficult for small business owners. What is your view on it as someone who both represents much of the Chaldean community as well as someone who's owned businesses himself?
You asked a very broad question because I think it's so different when you take a city like El Cajon, which is the poorest city in the county.
Should they have their own minimum wage? That's something that's been talked about. It's been done in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you know, I'm familiar with that, too. And then, but I want to kind of let me go back, and I'm not dodging the question, but let me go back and say, when you compare El Cajon to, say, Santee, you'll notice like the median household income is substantially different.
Right.
La Mesa even, and when you look at the crime rate in these neighboring cities, I mean, a stone's throw away, the crime rate between different cities is substantially different.
When I ask members of the El Cajon Council about the problems with the poverty rate in El Cajon, their stock answer through the years has always been, you know, we have the lowest housing prices and the lowest, all these apartments, all these rentals. The answer is if we just didn't have all these rental units, we convert a lot of them to condos, we make the price of housing higher, more pride in home ownership, this is going to go away. What do you think about that belief?
Well, I come from an economics background. I have never heard of that formula being applied. Not to say that I've never seen it applied really to say that this is the answer.
How would you address the poverty? And then also back to the minimum wage.
Right.
Do you think it should be raised or not?
The minimum wage question is an easy one for me. I think it should be raised, but it also needs to be raised in a slow manner. An example, there were talks that it needs to jump from $8 to $10. Well, this is by no means the right way to do things. And I think it was Governor Jerry Brown who I think was saying that he wanted to do that. In economics, and when you're dealing with this sort of thing, a steady, small, steady increase example would be for capping it off at a five-year thing and every 6 months going up 10 cents, something that's would help people who are just struggling to pay their bills. It would put that extra at the end of the
month,
extra something in their pocket. If they're working, let's say, a month, 150 hours or 200 hours a month.
Beyond a small raise or a modest raise in minimum wage, perhaps, if you could wave a magic wand, what would be your solution to decrease poverty in El Cajon, particularly among the Chaldean population where there is high unemployment, despite many of them owning businesses? For those that don't, a lot of them are, you know, not employed.
So not to sound philosophical or anything, but the number one thing that us as a human species can do to end poverty is to empower women.
Ah.
So I don't want to come off as sounding philosophical, but this is the answer to many of the world's problems when it comes to poverty. Is anytime you go into a country and you empower women, you start to see an increase, an influx in the economic growth. Hands down, this is a proven fact. This is not anecdotal.
So at the local level, how do you empower women in East County or in El Cajon?
And then this again is a question of a culture, because when you take El Cajon, which has 28% Hispanic, 38% Chaldean American, 12% African American.
Yeah, it's actually a majority minority right now.
Yeah, it's a majority minority. So when you talk about that, and you understand the Middle Eastern culture is this sort of macho culture where women in the Middle East, in most countries, are second-class citizens. If you fly these people over here, and if they migrate here, it takes time for them to assimilate and to sort of see women on the same pedestal or the same level as men. Mm-hmm. Now, that can change, and that is already changing now with the upcoming generation, the Chaldean American and Middle Eastern generations, with women professionals in the workforce. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of time that it can cure itself.
Education and just time is...
It's an evolution. Right. It's an evolution of change and education. I think that a quicker fix, and I've said this different times, a quicker fix to the economic problem, like let's take El Cajon for an example. Mm-hmm. El Cajon's economic crisis it needs to be fixed by first addressing the crime rate. Example would be, no business that wants to come into El Cajon pouring millions of dollars into El Cajon's economy while having prostitution. Come 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock p.m., we have prostitution, whether it's on Main Street or 2nd Street. Graffiti is an issue.
Yeah,
vandalism.
Not good for business.
Burglary or walking in, opening your doors up for business one day and finding fecal matter and people asleep and homeless homeless problems outside of your door. No one wants to do that. So that's a quicker fix.
Now, we have some changes that are occurring in El Cajon. Mayor Lewis has stepped down. Bill Wells has been appointed the new mayor. And as we're taping this right now, they're in the process of deciding who to appoint for the vacant council seat. But there will be at least two changes, so to speak, there. What direction do you think we may see? First of all, do you think we're going to see significant change with these leadership shifts? And what would your goals be? What would you hope to see this new council with two new faces doing?
I want to say that I was really sad and displeased when Mayor Lewis resigned. Mm. So, and for the viewers listening as to why is a Chaldean American Ben Kalasha saying that? Mm-hmm. Because anytime somebody resigns and there's an opportunity for an appointment, this really harms the democratic process, the voting process.
So you would have liked to see a special election?
I would have totally liked to see a special election, only because people get an opportunity to participate rather than it being a decision made between four people. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people who are uneducated said that, well, this is a victory for Chaldean Americans, and we thank the Neighborhood Market Association for bringing this to light. Well, it really is not a victory for Chaldean Americans. It really did a harm for Chaldean Americans.
Very interesting.
Because now they cannot vote. They didn't have an opportunity to vote as to who the mayor was, and they got appointed. So there's a big educational campaign that we are doing through our chamber to educate people as to this was not the right way to go.
Now, we've seen at least three Chaldeans, you being one of them, who put their name in the hat wanting to be appointed to fill that vacancy. Do you think we're going to see more political involvement with Chaldeans? And do you think that ultimately we'll be seeing some new faces on the council who come out of the Chaldean American community?
You know, I've opened up Pandora's box with the involvement of Chaldean Americans.
You were the first to run along with Ben Shimon last time around.
Yeah, and you know, well, notably, I lost by less than 1%, which is I had the most realistic chance of pretty much any Chaldean who's ever sought office in East County here. You know, I came real close to unseating Bob McClellan, who has been on the city council since I was 9 years old. But to me, it's not whether or not we need to have a Chaldean in office. That's making a mockery of the whole thing.
In other words, it's more important to have someone who is sensitive to the issues of the minority communities that now comprise the majority of the voters or of the citizens of El Cajon.
Let me say it in a little bit different way than saying sensitive. We need a person who is current on the dynamic of where they are representing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it's sensitive, and I'm not too... I don't like when people have to always watch what they say and are always afraid of the backlash. That's not what we're about here either. Yeah. But I want to say that you need to be current. You need to not make such remarks. Everybody makes mistakes, but don't make some of these remarks that
Which end is, frankly, a lot of the good that's been done. I know that Mary Lewis did do some outreach, and he would get out and attend a lot of the different Chaldean events and things. So you're right, a remark like that really sort of negates a lot of the positives that perhaps have been.
Yeah, and it covers up pretty much the 20 years that he's been there over, you know, he went out in shame, basically. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the thing, as I'm saying, is it doesn't matter who they appoint, whether that person is Hispanic, African-American, Chaldean-American, Muslim-American, Republican, Democrat. I mean, listen, this is a nonpartisan race. We want to get the best person for the job. At the same time, though, we need to pick somebody who is current. And when I say current, I mean current on every – I've been to more city council meetings than city council members. And I'm not saying that that it should be me or what have you. It just should be a person who is current and well-versed on every aspect of what makes up El Cajon – El Cajon.
Well, there you go.
So what makes El Cajon – you know, they need to conquer and understand – everything that has to do with the people who live in Fletcher Hills, understand with the Gillespie Field issue, understand the groups that run out there with ASAP, understand what goes on in Granite Hills area, understand the problems on 2nd Street, the parking problems and traffic on Main Street, understand the center of El Cajon with all the apartments, understand all those things. Mm-hmm. And that's the person who would be the best for the job. Doesn't matter, male or female, minority or party group.
As the Chaldeans are moving beyond El Cajon into some of the other East County communities, such as La Mesa, that now has a lot of them, some in Santee, do you think that we're going to see more political involvement in those communities and perhaps candidates arising out of the Chaldean community, or at least their issues being brought to the forefront in campaigns in some of these adjacent areas?
Well, you know, I obviously encourage it, and this is America, after all. This is what it was built on, is you know, everybody here is an immigrant. So, you know, whether it was the Irish Americans or mm-hmm. what have you, and then look at what they've done now, or it's the German Americans, and it's a matter of time. Though, again, I want to go back and say that I've opened up Pandora's box to this thing, and I'm making people realize, though many of them don't know how hard it is, but I'm making them realize that, yes, you can have a voice and you can represent whatever minority group or ideas you have, though I caution whoever is a Chaldean American to run to have an open mind to it and not have a bias for just your own minority group, mm-hmm. but to have to be this person cheering humanity.
What do you think about Mark Arabo's suggestion? He's been before the council quite a few times now, mm-hmm. in El Cajon, among others. Kathleen Harmon, some others have come forward from other communities as well of color and have said that they would like to see district-wide elections held. In other words, where you don't just have everybody in the community voting for all five candidates, where you would have El Cajon carved up into districts and each district would elect its own representative. Should that happen, in your opinion?
The easy answer for me is to say, yes, it should be carved out into districts, because then I would win easily. But I'm not going to say that. And I think that carving out El Cajon into districts, well, first you need to look at who is championing this and what the
and
real
who draws the lines and where they go.
Yeah, who draws the lines and who's championing this and what's the real agenda behind it. And so when you say, well, it's Mark Arabo or the Neighborhood Market Association, they're a trade organization, so mm-hmm. there's obviously an agenda there.
Yeah, but I don't know that you can draw lines just around all the markets and liquor stores, though.
No, but I mean, they're representing markets and liquor stores who are owned by Chaldean Americans. Is basically
But are there areas
underlining
that have a heavy Chaldean population where, if the lines were drawn in a certain way, that you might have more?
Well, of course there are, and I've walked El Cajon when I was campaigning. I've walked all the 56 precincts.
Or for that matter, I should ask: are there Latino precincts there too, or African American?
There definitely are those too. But again, it says what it does. It's a divide. You're dividing. You're starting to make lines, and you're making clicks.
So
now,
you're not for district elections, then?
No, it's funny. You'd presume I would be, because mm-hmm. now remember, if I'm running for the entire city of El Cajon, and I have to cover 56 precincts, now all of a sudden I have to cover 10 or 12. you would obviously bet that I would win handedly.
Don't wear out as much shoe leather walking the precinct.
Right. I mean, yeah. But I mean, it's again, I'm all about not being exclusive and not dividing people, mm-hmm. not dividing ethnicities, and not making cliques. We already have enough of that garbage going on. So I don't see a problem with it. Again, the person that needs to be elected needs to be current mm-hmm. and needs to know economics before they know where they are, where they stand, either whether socially or how they stand on social issues. Because understand, this is city council politics. They're never going to vote on topics like abortion.
So single issue voting can.
That's the most harmful thing, is single issue voting, in my opinion, is the most harmful thing. If somebody's going to vote on a candidate because they are, pro-gay rights, for abortion or not, this is just, it's comedic almost, because they're never going to vote on that here. I'm sorry, but this is just a waste of your time.
At the council level.
At the council level, you're wasting your time. And arguably even at higher levels. I mean, this isn't just a one person signing on a piece of paper making laws. You know, we have a process here.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know, Ben, before we conclude this interview today?
We are looking to make a huge impact in our community. When I say we, I'm referring to the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce at www.chaldeanamericanchamber.com for our upcoming events. And we look forward to working and serving our community.
Thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, Ben.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
If you're purchasing an artificial holiday tree, look for the label Fire Resistant. When purchasing a live tree, be sure to check for freshness. When setting up the tree at home, keep it away from fireplaces and radiators. Heated rooms dry live trees out rapidly, so be sure to keep the stand filled with water and use only lights that have been tested for safety by a recognized testing laboratory. Check each set of lights, new and old, for broken or cracked sockets, frayed or bare wires, and throw out any damaged sets. Replace burned out bulbs promptly with the same wattage. Use no more than 3 standard size sets of lights for each single extension cord. Don't use electric lights on a metallic tree. The tree can become charged with electricity from faulty lights, and a person touching a branch could actually be electrocuted. Turn off all lights when you go to bed or leave the house. The lights could short out and start a fire. Never use lighted candles on a tree in homes with small children. Take special care to avoid sharp or breakable decorations. Keep ornaments with small removable parts out of the reach of children or pets. And don't use tree preservatives if you have pets or small children, because drinking the water could be toxic. Happy holidays and stay safe.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road,
A.K. Jules,
Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment.
If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.